Hello, and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. We are the boyfriends. I'm Billy Ray.
And I'm Joel.
And in today's episode, we're going to be reviewing Season 7, Episode 17, Everything's Different, Nothing's Changed.
Yes.
Which is a very poetic kind of title.
It is very poetic, yeah.
So in this episode, I'm going to be doing the outline and leading the episode, and Joel is going to be giving us his trivia and his fun facts and so on. Do you have anything to start us off with?
I always do. The episode aired on the 3rd of April 2011 and was directed by David Warren and written by Annie Weissman. So the title of this episode, it comes from the lyrics in the song Sorry Grateful, which is taken from the Stephen Sondheim musical Company. Alex Kaminis, who's played by Todd Grinnell, returns in this episode, and he was last seen in Season 5, Episode 15, In a World Where the Kings Are Employers. And it's been quite a big gap, I must say. It's been two seasons.
I didn't even remember what his name was.
This is, however, Alex's final appearance in the series.
They invited him back to say goodbye.
Pretty much. Despite Bree being a match and her willingness to donate her kidney, nothing is actually ever mentioned about it in this episode. Because obviously Beth shot herself, and so there's the whole storyline of will they, won't they, but this time it's with a kidney. But because Bree is also capable of donating a kidney, I'm surprised she didn't basically have a chat with Susan and say, look, if it's really going to be that big of a deal, I'm also a donor.
Mm.
And then it would have lowered, but that would have lowered the stakes, wouldn't it? So
yeah, I get what you mean, though. It's not a life or death situation with Beth for Susan.
No. So this week, a 2,500-year-old preserved human brain dating from the Iron Age is found in Heslington in the English city of York, which I thought was pretty fierce. The International Atomic Energy Agency calls a summit in Vienna to tackle concerns about nuclear safety following the Fukushima crisis, which happened in March because there's been a month break between the last episode and this episode.
Has there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird.
Around 4,000 bodies of people who died in the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in the Iwate prefecture remain unidentified.
Damn, that's a lot.
It was a big earthquake. Obviously, there was more prefectures than just the Iwate prefecture that it hit, but I'm not even going to try and butcher the other pronunciations of them, so we'll just leave it at that. North Korea is reported to now be on a state of high alert for radiation because of the Fukushima accident.
Mm.
45,000 Inca artifacts taken by Yale University from Machu Picchu almost a century ago and described by the president as the dignity and pride of Peru arrived in Lima after a long campaign by Peruvians to have them returned.
Good.
Yep. The orca, Tilikum, resumes performing shows at SeaWorld Orlando 13 months after being involved in the death of trainer Dawn Blanchow. Watch Blackfish on Netflix if you haven't already to learn more about that.
I guess it just goes to show you can get away with anything if you're famous.
You really can.
Yeah.
Diamonds worth millions are stolen from Basel World Watch and Jewelry Fair in Basel in Switzerland.
Damn.
Right. Penelope Cruz becomes the first Spanish actress to receive a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Fierce.
The US National Highway Traffic Safety Administration reports that the number of traffic deaths has fallen to 32,788 in the year 2010, which is the lowest level since 1949.
Oh, well, that's good.
Can't say it's stayed like that. Taylor Swift wins the Entertainer of the Year award at the Academy of Country Music Awards 2010, with Miranda Lambert winning four awards, including Female Vocalist of the Year.
Cool.
Moving on to songs, the number one song in the US, I'm sorry babe, you're going to hate this, is E.T. by Katy Perry featuring Kanye West.
I don't think that's a very good song. What can I say?
And the number one song in the UK is On the Floor by Jennifer Lopez featuring Pitbull.
That's very,
which
that's
isn't
cool.
Much better than the Katy Perry E.T. song, but it is better. And the number one movie for both the US and the UK was Hop.
What's that?
Hop was like a animated / live action movie about an Easter bunny or something.
Oh, well, that sounds dumb.
Well, yeah. I'm sure kids loved it. Clearly, it was a number one movie.
Mm.
And so that's everything I've got.
Okay. Well, then, let's hop into the episode.
Oh, my God, that was awful.
Previously, Susan was told that her condition has gotten worse and that she should do anything in life that she wants to now. Beth was kicked out by Paul and outcast by Felicia. And Bree told Beth about being a kidney match for Susan. And then she ended her life to ensure that Susan would get her kidney and not Bree's.
Petty.
Although the way I say that makes it sound really like some petty competition.
You've made it sound really petty. Like Beth took the ultimate sacrifice just so that she could win over Bree.
Yeah. Which she kind of did.
I mean, she did.
Now we're going to start this episode with Bree's story. So, After going to the hospital to celebrate Susan's new donor, but then the shock of being told about Beth, Bree wakes up and she looks really tired, probably feeling a lot of guilt and sadness over the whole situation with Beth and what they've just found out.
Yeah.
She answers a phone call from Karen, telling her to come over and collect her drunk gay son who has passed out on the sofa.
If I wanted a drunk homo on my couch, I would have married my college boyfriend.
Later, she takes him home with Andrew's husband helping. His name is Alex, but I forgot who he was, yeah, so that's why I called him at this point. Bree shouts at him, but Andrew defends himself, saying that all the houses look the same, and Bree berates him further for getting so drunk, reminding him of their genetic predisposition to alcoholism.
The disrespect to the gays, I will say this, like, this is sad. The fact that Andrew lives on the lane and we have not had him in the show more is a travesty in and of itself. But to just bring him back just to make him an alcoholic.
Yeah, and he didn't really have that interesting a story last season either.
No, he really didn't. Wasn't that with Sam?
Yeah.
That was with Sam and his, like, jealousy over Sam.
He passes out on his own sofa this time as Bree and his husband start to talk about Andrew's problem and how he's been drinking a lot recently, and says that he's thinking of leaving him, but Bree convinces Alex to give her time to talk to him first.
And in this scene, Bree says that she can be quite resourceful because she once smuggled vodka into church in a Jesus Save sports bottle.
Yeah.
Now, I want to know where the hell she got a Jesus Save sports bottle from.
And what does it need saving from?
It.
Yeah, sports.
No, it's not saying Jesus Saves Sports on the bottle. It's a sports bottle that says Jesus Saves.
Oh, that makes more sense. Okay. Well, now that that's cleared up.
Oh my god.
So Bree and Andrew are dropping some catering stuff off, with Andrew thinking that he's helping her deliver gifts. Why are you laughing so much?
Jesus Saves Sports.
Can we stick to the facts pertaining to the case?
I just can't. Sports. Sorry, carry on. I'll sort myself out.
Bree and Andrew are dropping some catering stuff off, with Andrew thinking that he's helping her deliver goods, until they enter the building and realize that Bree has actually dragged him to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He doesn't want to attend, but Bree convinces him to stay, sort of. He then tells one of the members, like the chairman or whatever, I don't know what you'd call
the,
it.
The like leader.
The head
leader.
Of the meeting.
Yeah.
The cult leader. That his name is Elvis, much to Bree's dismay.
And yet another reason to hate my mother.
So we can all see where this is going, right?
Yeah, and Bree even says in this scene to Andrew that nobody needs to know they're related, which was a mistake on Bree's part.
Yeah, it was. And it's very like Andrew to take this moment to really have some jabs at his mum.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So Bree and Andrew, or Elvis, are in this AA meeting, no one knowing that they're related, and the chairman guy, or the cult leader, asks Elvis if he wants to talk about himself. He then tells the group about how much of a control freak his mother was, giving them plenty of stories, which gets a lot of awkward faces from the audience, with one member even saying that his mum sounds horrible.
Yeah.
And Bree clearly is getting more and more aggravated by the situation as it escalates.
There's a difference between sharing and whining. But it sounds like we've seen Bree be awful to Andrew, obviously, several times, because Andrew was quite awful. Almost from the very beginning, Andrew was quite antagonistic with Bree. But it's interesting to see some of the earlier stuff that might have led up to Andrew becoming antagonistic to Bree. He wouldn't have always been that way.
That's there one thing that moment. I like about this relationship is that because she's the main character, Andrew is the villain.
Mm.
But you have been able to see straight from episode one that as hardworking as she is, and as much as she cares about the family, that she is so overbearing.
Yeah.
And so religious about it all that you can completely understand Andrew's perspective from the get-go.
But to hear Andrew's story of him wanting to run for student council and then Bree basically telling him he's not a born leader, like, it makes you actually see that in hindsight she really didn't treat Andrew and Danielle that different.
So now that Bree has completely embarrassed herself, they then all start to pray together.
Yeah.
Which is when I would be out.
Yeah, Andrew does the right thing. Like, I say the right thing.
Yeah.
But Andrew does what I would do.
Yeah, they lock eyes and he does walk out.
Yeah.
And I don't blame him. I came here to get off of alcohol. Well, he didn't. But if I came to an AA meeting, it's because I don't want to be an alcoholic anymore. And this would make me really want a drink.
Yeah. This is the problem. I think we've discussed this. I can't remember if we've discussed it on the podcast or not, but we have discussed the fact that these Alcoholic Anonymous or these rehabilitation groups for addiction really focus on religion.
Yeah.
To such a degree that essentially, in my opinion anyway, it takes your addiction and picks it up from this one thing that it is, drugs, alcohol, whatever, and just moves it to a different addiction in the form of religion.
Yeah, you're not dealing with it, you're replacing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad that this has worked for so many people, but I do find the practice quite predatory.
Yeah.
So Bree visits Andrew on her way to the AA meeting, asks if he'll join her, but he tells her that he isn't going. He then tells Bree about his own problems, saying that he has no job while Alex works 18-hour shifts, and all he has is endless stretches of nothing in his day, only looking forward to kicking back and having a drink in the evening.
It's
why,
a really confusing...
why doesn't he get a job?
That's what I was just about to say. It's a really confusing scene. Like, it's made out like Andrew's only an alcoholic because he's bored and he feels like his life has no meaning. And so he complains that he doesn't have a job, but he doesn't say whether or not he actually tried to find one.
Yes, and I find it confusing because he had a very high up position in Bree's company. She could make a hell of a reference.
Yeah.
And because her company was so well known, I don't understand why he would struggle to find a job.
No, like, we don't know if he ever got another job after Bree sold the business.
I'm assuming not.
Like, I'm guessing not. And then, I mean, I don't blame him. I'd get drunk too if I resorted to dusting when I was bored. And then I felt proud of dusting.
And I think the problem is that if he has chosen to be a stay-at-home person, or a homemaker, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, which is very valid, he hasn't got really anyone his own age in the same position on that lane. What's he going to do? Spend his days with Susan and Gabby? Like, I don't think he wants to do that.
Yes, I would be doing that.
But I don't think he wants to do that. They're like 20 years older than him. It's not like he's going to go and get drunk and chat the shit with his mum's friends.
No, true.
That's awkward.
That is awkward. But like, it doesn't look like they've got a pet. There's no pet. There's no children. So once you've dusted, once you've cleaned the toilet or, you know, deep cleaned the oven, what is there to do? Like...
He tells Bree he'll be okay, and she walks out, only to come straight back in and tell him that someone on their street felt so desperate and alone that she just tried to kill herself, and that she won't walk away from someone who feels that way ever again. So Bree is very adamant that this isn't going to happen a third time on her watch.
Yeah.
Which I don't blame her for. Andrew then breaks down crying, saying that Alex left him as he couldn't live with a drunk. Bree brings up AA again, but Andrew can't do it. So Bree tells him that they can talk together instead.
Which I find more awkward than anything else.
Yeah, but she's been through it.
And she has been through it.
I found it very sweet.
And it's lovely development between the two characters. Like, it feels like, I've said it before, I think, but it feels like it's come full circle.
Yeah, it's weird how similar they are in some ways.
Yeah, considering that Andrew was only a child when Bree was initially struggling with her alcoholism, and now for it to come full circle, it's quite nice.
It's a nice little redemption opportunity for Bree as well.
Yeah.
Another one.
Yeah, with Andrew.
Let's move on to Gabby's story. So, Gabby visits Renee and seems judgy of Renee for continuing with her spring party with everything that's happening with Beth being in the hospital. Renee, however, defends herself, saying that Beth technically isn't dead yet and that she wasn't invited anyway.
I mean, Renee is saying all of the things we wish we could say, but we have tact. That's why we don't, right? Like, come on, I can't be the only one here thinking this.
I mean, we've always known that Renee wasn't a fan of her. The minute that she was like, the one with the bad hair.
The one with the bad hair?
Coming from her at the time as well.
And I have a hairdresser that could fix that.
So Gabby just kind of takes all of these excuses on board because she wants a party, basically. And we have a clip.
So you think it's okay that we still throw this party? Gabby, it's not a party. It's an event. Would you cancel the Oscars? Christmas? No. The invitations have been sent. The caterer's been hired. Life is for the living, so let's live. Well, the living did buy a new dress. Versace. And I'm sure Beth would have loved to have seen you in that Versace. She would have, wouldn't she? In a way, it could be a tribute to her. And I did see the perfect tribute shoes at the mall. Now that is the spirit. Now make sure the guests know the party is still on and I will take care of the arrangements here.
So these ladies are just finding any little excuse to party, aren't they?
Oh God, yeah. Well, it's established later in the episode that Renee has this spring fling every single year. So it's not just a random party for Renee, but obviously Gabby makes a very good point in basically saying that it's a bit insensitive to be throwing this party. However, I'm going to have to be the one to say it, or to back up Renee here anyway. People fall into comas and go brain dead, you know, all around the world that aren't invited to your party and you still have a party.
Yeah, but statistically, how likely is it to be someone you know?
Well, yeah, but she wasn't even invited.
Oh my God. Of course you're taking Gabby's side.
I'm taking Renee's side, not Gabby.
Yeah, but Gabby's the one that's like, I've already got the dress.
Gabby gets easily manipulated, and I'm very much Gabby in this instance, where I'm like, she would really have wanted to see me in this outfit.
I'm not sure she would have, though.
No, she absolutely would not have. But I just think that there is a way to go about this. You could just change the party to make it a celebration of life. It's spring, it's the spring fling, and spring is about life.
So Gabby is going around the neighbourhood to see who still wants to come to the party, and she gets a lot of flack from everyone. Even Mrs. Kinski tells Gabby that she's being disrespectful.
Yeah, I know. Like, Mitzi is proper power play in this scene as well. She goes, didn't you hear our neighbour Betty Young just blew her brains out? Calling her the wrong name.
This is the same woman who in the previous episode, we didn't even see Brie ask her about the kidney, and she was going, no. And she's the one that's calling Gabby disrespectful.
Also, I'm rather confused. Beth Young wasn't invited, but Mitzi Kinski was. Make that make sense.
She goes back to Renee, who refuses to change the date of her party, saying that she's had it the same time every single year, and that she isn't changing it for, and I quote, some cuckoo who decided to clean her head with a gun.
She's really hit the heartless zone in this episode, hasn't she, Renee?
Gabby then thanks her for making her to be the compassionate one for once, before doing her own little walk-off.
So it sounds like Gabby's not doing the party.
Although, I'll be honest, I didn't get from this scene that she's not going to go to the party. I just got it's a bit awkward, but I'm already in it. So Gabby is at Renee's and is stunned to see that so many people have actually come to the party, only to find out that most of the people at this party are actually people that work for them.
Yeah, or just around. Like, the guy from Animal Control is here. Like, even Gabby was like, isn't that the guy from Animal Control? At Renee's party, still in his uniform. Mm. Like, he's dressed as one of the kids from Stranger Things. He's like, in one of those greenish-grey boiler suits.
Yeah, he just came straight from work.
Yeah.
Gabby then gets a dig about how everyone who came is poor and has shit clothes.
Yeah. And there's teenagers here.
You know, their attitude is a little bit weird about this party. She's like, ew. Like, look at the guests.
Yeah.
And it's like, Gabby, stop being so stuck up. You're in suburbia now. So in the kitchen, she asks why Renee threw the party if everyone that she wanted to come was too sad. And Renee opens up about how she doesn't feel sorry for Beth, as it wasn't a horrible thing that happened to her. She brought it upon herself. She mentions how Beth probably didn't think about her family and mentions the word daughter.
Yeah, it was a bit of a faux pas there.
But Beth didn't have a daughter. So Gabby asks if Renee is projecting her own experiences on this situation, and they talk about how Renee's mother killed herself too. Renee then says that this party may seem insensitive, but it's her way of choosing life over death, and Gabby takes this moment to grab a drink and join the party.
Yeah.
This ending explains why Renee is so adamant about this party and her feelings, but I personally don't think it excuses it.
Oh no, I do think it was nice to get some development from Renee.
Oh yeah, I'm glad that she has something we have something to think about with her now.
Yeah, we finally got some sort of, like, there's layers there.
It's nice that she has someone that she can talk to about it rather than just drinking her problems away once a year, I suppose.
True.
Now, let's move on to Lynette.
Yes.
Tom comes home to Lynette after golfing with Carlos and a guy named Glenn, a big business guy in a big company doing business things. Lots of business words and jargon, they just go right over my head, but let's just say that he's a business guy.
Yeah.
They invite him in and he tells them he's looking for a new CFO, which is a chief financial officer, and he offers Tom the job. Apparently Carlos has bragged about him a lot, which is how he thought of Tom.
Yeah, and this dude is sneaky. Like, claiming he needs to use Tom and Lynette's loo just to speak to Tom behind Carlos's back, and that is something that I would watch out for.
That is really sneaky, because it's dishonest business. Well, a lot of business can be dishonest, but this is a really dishonest tactical move that I don't think is entirely necessary. You can just talk to Tom about it in front of Carlos, but then again, that might also be seen as a bit weird.
That would be seen as inappropriate in the business world. Like, it's like when a company messages you on LinkedIn, or, you know, you're networking and someone hears about you and, you know, they cherry pick you. So that's all he's doing, is cherry picking. But it's just the way he's gone about it in ensuring that he's deliberately out of earshot of Carlos. He's lied to Carlos. Carlos invited them over for a drink after the golf and he said, no, you better head home. He then lied to Tom and Lynette about needing to use their loo just to get them alone out of earshot of Carlos to then offer Tom a job.
He gets told about all of the benefits, including a big salary and access to a company jet. Like, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
But Tom refuses, basically saying that he's loyal to Carlos, which clearly annoys Lynette.
Yeah.
The guy leaves and Lynette tries to convince him to take up the offer, but Tom stands his ground and says that this is his decision and he's saying no.
I mean, Lynette is a businesswoman through and through, so of course she would want Tom to throw Carlos under the bus.
Yeah, but mad respect for Tom in this scene, to be honest.
I mean, so I was literally going to ask, like, what you would do in this situation.
I would do what Lynette suggests doing, which is talking to Carlos about it and say, I've been offered this job somewhere else. I'm loyal and I don't want to leave this place, but, like, I have to think about my family. What can we, is there anything that you can do?
You're such a stand-up guy. You always find a happy medium.
Well, that's what I
wouldn't
do.
Take the job, but I'd talk to Carlos first and then maybe take the job. And me, I'd just be like, nah, throw Carlos under the bus. You did the same to me.
No, but this is a moment where you can see what you're worth in this company.
Yeah.
What value they think you hold. Mm. Because that could also be a deciding factor. If they're so unwilling to do anything, I'd be like, okay, well then I'll leave.
Yeah. And at the same time, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a good jump. Just because you're being thrown accolades, promotions and pay rises and company jets doesn't mean that in the long run it's going to be better for you if you stay at a firm which you are loyal to and are loyal to you.
Yeah, it's always a risk though, because you don't know if the job's going to be shit and the workplace is going under, or that the sneaky ass weird boss who's gone out of his way in such a weird way to try and get you on board is actually like embezzling or something.
Grass isn't always greener.
So Tom is in bed reading when Lynette walks in and tries out her sexy air hostess routine on Tom. She then says, only hot shot executives like you get to fly our jet. And Tom reminds her that he isn't taking the job.
Mm-mm.
She praises him for his loyalty, but says how annoyed she is about it, and he promises that he'll at least talk to Carlos and see if he can match the salary, leading to Lynette starting up her routine again. And quite frankly, Tom, this should have been your first thought.
I was literally about to say, finally, it's been said. Like, you said it in the previous, when we were discussing the previous scene, finally, it has been said. Why is Tom the one with the career again, when it has taken him so long to think, maybe I'll talk to Carlos and ask if he can match what I'm offered? But what we also establish in the scene is, Tom's not good at dirty talk.
No, he's not. She's like, okay, you're not good at this, let me do the talking. I love that. Tom is with Carlos in his office and has told him about the offer. And then Tom says that it was a generous offer and that he wants to step up. However, Carlos says that they can't afford such an offer, but offers him some more perks instead. Back at home, Lynette tells him that everything Carlos just offered is a load of crap, and that Carlos actually keeps the leftover budget for himself at the end of the year, which you hear about a lot in shows.
You do, yeah.
She knows, as she had a very high paid job herself at said company, and so she has seen these exchanges. He asks why she keeps pushing him, and she says that if she doesn't, he goes nowhere, which feels like a bit of an ooh kind of moment.
But she's not wrong.
It offends Tom, but Lynette doesn't back down, telling him that he's a 40-year-old businessman still trying to establish himself and that he needs to be ruthless and take these opportunities when they come. But Tom tells her that he'll get ruthless if she doesn't back down.
Oh, this scene is a lot.
It's a bit awkward because I watched it and I was like, what kind of a limp dick fuck can't get ruthless in his business and take up opportunities, but then he threatens his wife?
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Like, Lynette isn't wrong, and maybe I'm biased because I can't stand Tom. But he hasn't gone anywhere without the help of Lynette. Like, he wouldn't be in the job he has right now if Lynette didn't get it first and then needed him to take over when she had the baby. He wouldn't have got the liquor license back when he had the pizzeria if Lynette hadn't have stepped in and got involved. And there are countless other situations where Lynette has had to get involved to help Tom.
Also, because he's stepping in for her, could he not take up the job and Lynette take back her old job and then they could have the best of both worlds?
I mean, I guess, yeah. Also, I find it interesting that the job that Tom is being offered by this other dude is CFO, which is Chief Financial Officer. But what Tom is doing for Carlos is marketing.
Yeah, it's different fields.
They're different fields. The most finance experience I imagine he would have had was from running his own business. Because obviously with that comes tax and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But babe, it's his dream to get into finance.
Don't you fucking, I swear to God, it's, oh my God.
It's his season 7 dream.
It's his season 7 dream.
Lynette is at a car dealership and picks up a very expensive looking sports car, saying it's for a neighbour, and then she leaves it in Carlos's driveway to, like, you know, try out.
And the dude that's selling it to her is totally turned on by Lynette.
Oh yeah.
Why do men just love women that love fast cars?
Yeah, or a woman that knows cars.
Or a woman that knows cars. Like, let's not forget how mental everyone got at Megan Fox in Transformers.
Tom then comes home and is annoyed that Carlos would buy a new car after telling Tom that he couldn't afford to give him that salary boost. and Lynette convinces him to take the other job instead. Although, I will say, I don't really understand how Carlos buying a car with his own money is any indication that the company couldn't afford to give Tom a pay increase, because, like, Carlos is on a lot of money. He wouldn't have to save up that much to get that car.
No, he really wouldn't.
So I feel like there are holes in this story. But anyway, Tom is clearly very annoyed with Carlos, and he decides to take the job, booking a lunch with the guy for the next day. He then says that he's going to give Carlos a piece of his mind. Now, this is a big snag in Lynette's plan, because she did not think he had the balls.
I don't think any of us figured out he had the balls.
Lynette follows him over as he storms off and admits what she did, with Tom telling her to get in the car so that they can return it to the dealership. However, when they get in the car, Lynette tells Tom that he could drive this car. He could have this life. He then starts up the car and gets that sort of big straight man energy as he revs the engine.
Yeah.
And then he starts to drive the car. And they then decide not to return the car on time and maybe have a bit of fun.
It's weird. Lynette, I kind of feel bad for Tom in this scene, because Lynette does sit there. She has the audacity to look him in the eye and say, I understand if you want to say no. Bitch, he has said no.
That's the thing, Lynette. If you did understand why he'd want to say no, none of this would be happening.
No, exactly. I'm like, you've got the audacity to look this man in the eye and be like, look, I get it. If you want to say no,
then let him say no.
Let him say it then. Listen to him when he says it.
Yeah, it's an awkward episode, because I feel like Tom isn't thinking very smartly, and he didn't want to take this opportunity to go to his boss and see what he could get. But he's not the same kind of business person that Lynette is, but she knows that.
Yeah.
And so you have to stop interfering at some point, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But
does she?
Housewives be desperate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's move on to Susan. Susan and Mike are watching TV when she gets a phone call from a doctor at the hospital telling her that they found a kidney for her and that she needs to get to the hospital ASAP. This scene also happens at the same time as Paul's story, which we'll talk about later. So it kind of reminds us of that conversation Susan had with Dick in a previous episode about how when they receive good news through these beepers, someone else is receiving bad news.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot all about Dick. And that's not really a sentence I would normally say.
Susan gets to the hospital to find the ladies holding presents, hospital presents that is, like, you know, balloons and flowers and such,
yeah,
to celebrate her kidney donor. And there's a little bit of awkwardness with Renee and the party, which we've spoken about earlier, but we have a clip.
We are so thrilled for you. When is this happening?
I guess tonight. So will you still be at my party Saturday? Because you did RSVP.
Well, it depends. Can you move the party into the intensive care unit?
So that's a no. Gabby's in charge of the guest list, in case anybody else decides to flake at the last minute.
Hello, Susan. Well, I didn't know you'd be bringing an entourage.
Well, it's a happy day on our street.
I would imagine a bit of a sad one, too.
No, I can just call the caterer, say this one less person. No big deal.
No, just call the caterers. Oh my god.
She's in her own little world, Miss Renee.
It's another moment of complete misunderstanding from the characters that make comedy. We have it all the time, obviously. It's been a little while since we've really seen it.
It's a misunderstanding, and the doctor explains what he's talking about, which is that their neighbour, Beth, shot herself.
Yeah.
So he explains what happened in the previous episode, and it shocks the ladies. And he also says that her husband, Paul, is currently with Beth, so things are kind of on hold with the kidney. The ladies then have a sad conversation, feeling sorry for Beth, with Bree lamenting the fact that she didn't see something wrong the previous day, and everyone goes home for the night.
I'm confused as to why Susan invited the ladies to the hospital.
I have no idea. Maybe I don't think she did. I think she just called them with the good news.
Because it's a bit, well, it's, even then, it's a bit too soon to be telling them the news, right?
Well, the doctor told her to get to the hospital right away.
Yeah.
So I assumed it would be like, let's operate. But then I was also a bit like, well, wouldn't you want to see how the conversation with the husband goes first?
Exactly.
I mean, I'm not telling doctors how to do their job, but still.
I think it was too soon to call Susan, considering it's only just happened. And I think they got a little bit eager beavery there. And I think it was also too soon for Susan to call her friends, considering the history that Susan has had with kidneys already.
So Susan sees Paul in the hospital and tells him how sorry that she is about Beth and that she's so grateful for the kidney, trying to give him comfort and saying that she kind of gets to live on in some way, which is such a Susan thing to say. Because I would also be like, no, absolutely not.
Yeah,
not
after you, that. Not you. After hearing that sentence, I'm like, ew, no.
No, not you. Never you. Paul, however, tells Susan that he plans to keep Beth alive as soon as possible, refusing to let Susan have the kidney, saying that she wasn't in her right mind when she was signing those papers, and that Susan doesn't deserve her kidney as she, and the other ladies, never invited Beth over, showed her any kindness in her life, before doing a walkout.
Yeah, and he's not wrong.
No, he's not wrong. They were all extremely judgy, and none of them learned their lessons, and it just went on, and history repeated itself many times.
They were all horrible to Beth. So, yeah, I am with Paul in that instance.
In the next scene, Mike is talking to the doctors, who are saying that they basically can't take Paul to court. Even though they would probably win, they wouldn't be able to afford the legal action and fees beforehand, which does make sense considering some of the things that have happened in this hospital. Hello, Juanita Solis.
Yeah.
This is not a job I could do.
No, I know. And Mike sounds crazy in this scene. Paul Young has a vendetta, he's punishing me and my wife. And if I was the director of the hospital, I'd be like, right, sir, sure. Yeah.
Mike then wants to take Paul to court, but Susan says no, saying that this is actually Paul's decision and that she just wants to go home, seemingly kind of over the whole thing.
Very big of Susan, I will say.
Yeah, and you know what? I get that. It's like, someone's just died. Let's not make a thing of it.
Exactly. Like, at the end of the day, he's grieving as well.
And as we know, Bree's a match. It's no biggie.
Yeah.
Now, let's finish up Susan's story quickly. Mike is talking to Susan and asks why she won't fight for the kidney, and she tells him it feels wrong because she thinks that Paul is actually correct and that her final wish made no sense. Mike tries to convince her otherwise, but she says that she can't take the kidney, knowing that she might be the reason that Beth is lying in the hospital.
Here comes the conflict and confusion with Susan.
It's so sad.
Yeah.
Like, what a horrible mindset. That's awful.
It's true, though. And we all knew it was going to happen. Susan would have this conflict because it's classic moment for a TV show, isn't it?
And it's a classic Susan moment. She overthinks everything. Yeah.
But it's the conflict and the confusion now. It's the, do I deserve this kidney after how I treated her? And why was she so adamant on me getting the kidney in the first place? It's the conflict and confusion that Susan's now going through, and why she now fully believes that she doesn't deserve this.
Now let's talk about Paul's story and let's wrap up. Paul is eating dinner when the phone rings and a doctor at the hospital informs him of Beth's suicide attempt. This is happening at the same time that Susan got her good news.
Yes.
The doctor says that she is brain dead and being kept on life support at the moment, and that she is an organ donor, and Paul tells them not to do anything with Beth until he gets there.
Now,
that's curious.
Yes, we have had this chat in Susan's story about if his wife is a registered organ donor, surely he doesn't really have a say in her body because she's registered. So that's her wish. Obviously, it is now commonplace law in the UK that you are automatically registered as an organ donor, mm-hmm. and then you have to choose to opt out of it as opposed to...
Which I like.
The other way, which I like as well. I'm a registered organ donor. I would suggest everybody register to be an organ donor as well, but obviously it's preference. But I did a little bit of quick research, and according to the NHS website, family can halt donation even if you are a registered organ donor.
Wow, men having control over women's bodies even in their death.
Yeah. So if you die and you are registered as an organ donor, even if you've got that card, the family can still halt it and have the decision.
Although that's in the UK because you said NHS, but I'm going to assume that it's probably the same thing in America.
Probably.
After telling Susan that he isn't going to let her have Beth's kidney, he goes to the prison to visit Felicia in the chapel room. And Felicia is clearly distraught, so she did at least love Beth in her own crazy way. Or at least it seems that way for now, although later on kind of questions that theory a little bit.
Girl's just a good actress, and credit to her. I'm giving her all the credit for this. Like, I'm glad she calls Paul out, though.
Mm.
Even if she's... you know, fake crying, and she's also the villain in this because nobody really cared about Beth, which makes me so angry. I care about you, Beth. I'm here. I care.
Yeah, Paul thinks that Felicia is trying to use Beth to hurt him, but Felicia tells him that they don't get to use Beth anymore and that she was the only innocent party in all of this. Paul says that maybe she can recover because he hasn't been listening, but Felicia doesn't think so. She says they both did this to Beth and that they have to stop and let her rest before Paul does a walkout.
Yeah, so this scene was fun because it's been a long time since we've had a scene with Felicia and Paul, and they're always fun together, but to hear Felicia call him out and to basically confirm to Paul that Beth did actually love him, even though he didn't believe her when she said it, it was quite sad. It was really sad to hear Felicia say there was nowhere for Beth to go. You threw her out because you didn't believe she loved you, and I turned her away because she did love you. and she had nowhere to go. And it was so sad. Oh, it gets me upset.
Well, yeah, she really was an innocent party in all this, like she says.
Yeah.
Mostly innocent.
And I love that they kept Felicia's hand with the missing fingers off screen in this scene, so they don't have to make her wear, like, the green screen finger sleeves or whatever that she would have had to have worn.
Yeah, I wonder how they do that.
I don't know. I imagine it's green screen finger sleeves, which is fun to say. Green screen finger sleeves. It's so fun. Guys, say it. Say green screen finger sleeves right now, wherever you are. Say it out loud.
Green screen finger sleeves.
You could be in the office, walking down the street, having a jog, whatever you do to listen to us. You know, Bee's mum, you're a nurse. I see you. You could be, you know, working on a patient right now.
Ordering a coffee.
Just say green screen finger sleeves.
Say. Paul comes to Susan's house, and seeing that he is clearly in a bad way, she lets him in. Oh, I said house. Her flat. He tells her that he's going to the hospital to see Bev and to say goodbye, and that she should receive a call about the kidney soon. Susan is quite confused, but he says that he would be grateful if she could forget some of the horrible things that he said. Susan then says that he was right about what he said about Beth, and asks why she would do this when she didn't deserve it, but he tells her that Beth didn't love people because they deserved it, and that they can honour her memory by living and being well for her son, family, and friends. And Susan accepts. She tells him one last time how sorry she is for what happened to his wife, and Paul says he is too, before crying, and Susan hugs him.
And when Paul cries, he puts his hand to his face, and it looks like he's smiling, which gives real big villain energy. Like, he's plotting to actually not give Susan the kidney and to take it away at the last minute again.
Yeah. Like. So, that was a nice moment.
Yeah, maybe this is a turning point for Susan and Paul.
Kind of like a redemption for this story, at least.
Yeah, Paul. Well, he's still not had redemption for killing Martha Hubert. Definitely not from you. She was your favourite character in the world, but...
Yeah. But what can you do? The episode ends, and we see Susan being taken into surgery as Paul says goodbye to Beth, which is heartbreaking. And also, Felicia is visited by the prison warden, who tells her that she's been granted humanitarian release, and then she turns away and gives this evil, cunning smile.
Yeah, she finally got some use out of Beth in the end, I guess.
Like, the crying just stops.
Her
dead ass.
Yeah, dead ass. Her last words to Beth were, "I have no more use for you, goodbye."
Little did she know.
Yeah,
she did.
She literally was able to get a little bit more use out of Beth in the end.
And thus ends the episode.
Yeah.
Now let's move on to our next segment, where Joel's going to give us the gayest and the straightest moments of the episode. So what do you have for gayest moment?
My award for gayest moment goes to Renee for still wanting to party.
Yeah. Yeah.
I give it to Renee, even though a part of me also, the part of me also kind of wanted to give it to Felicia for that moment where she's like, my daughter was in that house.
Yeah, I get that. But not even that. Renee's also like, I'm doing it as a way to celebrate her life. It's like, no, you just want to do shots.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then what do you have for straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment. I know, part of me feels like I should give it to Tom for the big dick energy he gives with the driving of the new car, but I feel like that's like cliche. So I'm giving it to Mitzi Kinski for getting Beth's name wrong.
But the cliche-ness is the whole point of the award, isn't it?
No, I feel like everyone wants me to steer towards Tom, and I'm going to Kinski because it gives straight bro energy, not even bothering to learn the girl's name just because he knows he's going to get laid.
Fair, fair.
And now we move on to Bee's Awards for Best and Worst Parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
My award for...
Best Parent of the Episode.
It goes to Bree for her support of Andrew and his alcoholism.
Alcoholism.
Which is a nice turnaround for her.
It is. Yeah, I that's deserved, in my opinion. That is rightfully deserved.
Season 1 Bree to Season 7 Bree. Different people.
Different, completely different people. So who do you have for the worst parent?
My award for...
Worst parent of the episode.
It obviously goes to Felicia.
Obviously, yeah.
For fake crying when her daughter dies.
Using the death of her daughter.
Yep, she uses her daughter's death to get out of prison, yeah, to further her plans of world domination.
And she is also part of the reason why her daughter is dead in the first place, so...
Yeah, which she does admit, but only as a means to
play her act. Yeah.
So... That was Season 7, Episode 17, Everything's Different, Nothing's Changed. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments, and or theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at Boyfriends Review. You can find us on TikTok at Boyfriends Review. And we are also expressing our unsolicited opinions on Reddit at Boyfriends Review Pod.
Our email is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, and the artwork is done by our friend Louis, who you can find on Instagram at docrenmonkdesign, and there is a link to his Etsy page as well. Join us next time when we'll be back in your ear holes with Season 7, Episode 18, Moments in the Woods.
Ooh.
I already know what that comes from. I don't even need to look up the trivia for that song.
No.
See you then, guys.
Bye.
Bye.